doctoral student and chronic disease epidemiologist at the Yale School of Public Health and a research analyst at Fenway Health in Boston. Come on up, Jackie.
Hey, everyone. So today I'm going to be presenting on barriers to medical gender affirmation among transgender adults in Massachusetts. And I have no conflicts of interest to disclose. So transgender, or trans, as many of you know, refers to individuals whose gender identity differs from their assigned birth sex. And folks may use a variety of different terms to describe themselves, but this is how we're defining it, particularly in the study. And so the exact prevalence of trans people in the U.S. is unknown, largely because trans people have been excluded from population surveys. Although there's change underway in that area. But estimates suggest that anywhere from 0.1 to 0.5% of the U.S. population identifies as transgender. So as far as gender affirmation, people affirm their gender in a variety of ways. And so one of the ways individuals, and transgender individuals in particular, will affirm their genders through social means. So it's changing one's name, different use of pronouns, clothes, or other forms of gender expression. There's also legal forms of gender affirmation, so changing one's name on passports or social security cards, licenses, and also changing one's gender marker. Here we're going to be talking about medical gender affirmation, or gender transitioning. So this would include use of masculinizing or feminizing hormones, surgery, and while there's been a movement towards an informed consent model for medical gender affirmation whereby individuals can go through their medical provider in order to access medical gender affirmation, for some folks, particularly those who are dealing with gender dysphoria, they may access mental health treatment as well. And so within the healthcare context, there's a variety of barriers that may impede trans folks from accessing healthcare. And so this can include provider bias. And sometimes provider bias is actually rooted in prejudice, although sometimes provider bias may be due to lack of education. There's been research that's shown that North American medical schools, that the median number of hours dedicated to LGBT health broadly was less than 5. And so providers aren't getting the education they need to be able to successfully care for transgender people in culturally and medically competent ways. We also see that mistreatment in healthcare context can lead to future healthcare avoidance, which has serious consequences for being able to access both preventative and emergency care. Other barriers to healthcare include insurance coverage. This can include lack of insurance coverage, as well as the denial of coverage for services. And while the Affordable Care Act now includes a provision that makes it illegal for insurance companies to discriminate on the basis of gender identity, there's still evidence that discrimination or denial of coverage for services may be happening, and particularly at the time that the study was conducted. We also see cost as a barrier. Many medical gender affirmation procedures or surgeries are not covered by insurance, and so it can be a big burden to be able to pay out of pocket for these services. So this study is based on Project Voice, which was a community needs assessment conducted in Massachusetts in 2012. It was led by the Massachusetts Trans Political Coalition and as well as Fenway Health. So we recruited transgender and non-binary folks age 18 years and older who lived in Massachusetts in the past year. The study was conducted online, but we also did in-person recruitment efforts targeting individuals at Pride events as well as trans community events to have a more diverse sample of people who might otherwise be able to access an online survey. So this particular analysis, we described the frequency of demographic and access to healthcare experiences among transgender individuals in Massachusetts. We looked at factors that were associated with access to medical gender affirmation, and our goal is to use these findings to advance policies to support transgender health. So of the total sample, 452, we excluded those who were not seeking medical gender affirmation. This left us 364 individuals who had attempted to access some form of medical gender affirmation in the past 12 months. So we looked at a variety of different measures, including age, race, ethnicity, assigned sex at birth, current gender identity, whether folks had reported socially transitioning or living full-time in their current gender identity, education, employment, annual income, and then type of insurance coverage, so whether it was public, private, or whether folks had no insurance at all. For the healthcare avoidance variables, we looked at whether individuals had reported delaying or avoiding preventative care due to discrimination as well as cost. And so these are how the questions were worded in the survey. As far as access to care measures, we also looked at whether individuals reported experiencing discrimination in healthcare in the past 12 months, yes or no, whether individuals reported having to teach their provider about transgender care, whether they had been outright refused care in the past 12 months, and our primary outcome variable was looking at whether individuals had been unable to access transition-related care or medical gender affirmation in the past 12 months, yes or no. And so our sample was largely on the younger side. 54% were between 18 to 29. We had a mean age of 33. The majority were white, non-Hispanic, and while we did take efforts to try to recruit a more diverse minority population, this is actually similar to the racial ethnic breakdown of the general population in Massachusetts. For gender spectrum, looking at folks that were on the transmasculine or F to M spectrum, 60% of the sample identified this way. 77% of the sample had socially transitioned. For demographics, we see that almost half were earning less than $35,000 a year, and almost half were also employed. For access to healthcare, we see that almost a quarter of the sample had been unable to access transition-related care or medical gender affirmation in the past year. So in a multivariable model, we looked at factors that were associated with ability to access medical gender affirmation. And so using those who had a graduate school education or higher, we see that folks who had some college or high school or less were at greater odds of being unable to access medical gender affirmation in the past year. For insurance, we see that compared to those who have public insurance, people who had private insurance or had no insurance at all were at greater odds of being unable to access medical gender affirmation care. And while the having no insurance makes intuitive sense, the private insurers are actually, especially at this time in Massachusetts, were able to restrict access to care in a way that the public insurers had guidelines around refusing care access on the basis of gender identity. When we look at the association of insurance coverage to lack of access to care, we don't see any significant differences whether folks were able to access hormone coverage or gender affirmation surgery coverage, but we do see that folks who had no mental health coverage were at greater odds of being unable to access transition-related care. If I could get through this quickly. As far as delaying care due to cost, those who had delayed preventative care due to cost were at greater odds of not being able to access gender affirmation care. Those who had who experienced discrimination in healthcare were at greater odds of being unable to access care, as well as those who had been refused care that were at greater odds of being unable to access care. We also see when folks delayed care due to discrimination, those who delayed preventative care and those who delayed emergency care were at greater odds of being unable to access transition-related care. So in summary, we see that transgender people experience discrimination in healthcare, that there's also the avoidance of healthcare due to discrimination as well as cost. We also see inadequate insurance coverage. And when we look at lack of access to medical gender affirmation, we see that it's associated with having less education, having private insurance or no insurance, and lack of mental health coverage. We also see discrimination in healthcare and refusal of care being associated with lack of access to medical gender affirmation. And we also see healthcare avoidance due to discrimination and cost being associated with lack of access to care. The study was not without limitations. These were cross-sectional data, so causality could not be assessed. So that's a non-probability convenience sample. However, there were a variety of strengths. We were able to engage a multidisciplinary community as well as community partnerships in order to recruit a large sample within Massachusetts. And it was a statewide data on a relatively hidden population if you figure that the trans people have been excluded from population surveys. Since the study has, since 2012, there has been passage of policies nationally and within Massachusetts that restrict insurers from denying individuals access to care on the basis of gender identity. Although at the time that the study was implemented, there were policies in the books that restricted individuals from being discriminated against on the basis of gender identity in education and employment, although people were still reported experiencing discrimination. So while these policies are a great movement, there actually has to be in the enforcement of these policies to make sure that folks have access to care. We need more research to be able to parse out the effects of these policies, but we also need interventions to ensure that we can eliminate discrimination in healthcare for trans folks, ensure access to insurance coverage for medical gender affirmation. I want to thank my wonderful colleagues, Dr. Sarah Reisner, who's co-author on this paper, Amelia Dunham, and John Pachankas. Also, my collaborators, Catherine Heflin, Jesse Bengini, and John Cahill, and then the wonderful folks who were part of the community who helped us put this survey together. And I'll take any questions at the end. Thanks very much.